I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. Wow, it really does sound like Leonard is having fun in Italy, scooting around on that Vespa. That sounds really amazing. Do you remember any of your dreams from last night? Did a nightmare wake you and leave you sweating and shaken? Did you have a funny dream, a sad dream, or no dream at all? What is the stuff that dreams and nightmares are really made of? Well, that is the subject of this week's edition of Please Explain. And I am joined by two dream experts, Dr. Andrew Gerber, the neuroscientist and assistant professor of clinical psychiatry in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University, and David K. Randall, journalist and author of Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep, published by W.W. Norton. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
We also invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question about dreams, nightmares, are you guys up for interpreting people's dreams? You going to do any of that? Or
do a little swami.
Do a little swami what these dreams mean. Well, I know a lot of people have questions about dreams. So anyway, our listeners can call us at 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Dr. Gerber, I will start with you. We'll get down to very basic sort of please explain territory. Is there a scientific or medical definition of dreams and dreaming?
So it's a fun question and one I think we've all wondered about at times. Dreams are a fun topic. They've been discussed and theorized about for hundreds, thousands of years. And so science, of course, has to have something to say about it because that's what we like to do as scientists. But the first thing I would say is that the definition of a dream is what we all would say from common sense, that dream is mental activity when we are asleep.
Okay. That's it. That's very easy to understand. That doesn't sound like a scientific explanation at all.
Well, the best science is easy to understand. The question, of course, is what fits into that definition, and that's a much tougher one. But if you start with the generalities and you start with the basics, then you can get into the fun questions.
Okay. Well, let's get into the question of nightmares. Is there a difference between just a run-of-the-mill bad dream and a nightmare? I mean, a nightmare is the thing where, you know, you wake up in a cold sweat and you're scared out of your mind. Is it just a question of degree? Or is there a different? Have we looked at the brain and seen that different things are going on between a bad dream and a nightmare?
So I'll tell you what we think we know so far, and this comes from a variety of different sources. What we think is that dreams that have the same basic structure, that is, dreams that have a narrative to them, dreams that have imagery, that have some sort of a plot line, no matter how bizarre, have the same sort of neural substrate, whether they be positive or negative. In fact, a lot of dreams have negative content to them. We can talk a little bit more about that. What the differentiation is in the scientific perspective is not between good dreams and bad dreams, but it's dreams with that kind of structure to them and the dreams that don't have the structure. There are also dreams that we can probably all think of, which maybe we don't even call dreams, where we just wake up with a generally bad feeling, where we have this
That's me on most days.
Right. So we think there's a different neural substrate to that mm-hmm. it happens at a different stage of sleep. And really a stage where our brain is doing less of this kind of reconstruction and interpretation than the dreams in which there's much more of a narrative. So to me, that's the more relevant dichotomy.
Mm-hmm. Now, David, even though we've always been dreaming's, you know, we've always, and dreams play such a role in literature and theater and all mm-hmm. that, the study of sleep and dreams is relatively new, right?
It is. You know, for so long, it was hard to kind of figure out what was going on in our head. Once somebody fell asleep, what could you do? You couldn't ask them what was happening. You
right.
could wake them up, but beyond that, there was not much you could do. Freud made people interested in dreams, and then in a weird way, he also made them disinterested in dreams. And I'm talking about scientists here. If the idea was, okay, let's unpack all these emotions, see what's happening in your dream, there was this French scientist named Michel Jouvet, and he basically did surgery on a cat's brain so that the cat was no longer paralyzing itself while it was sleeping, which all of us do and all animals do, so you don't act out all of your dreams. He could then see that the cat, when it was sleeping, all it was doing was trying to pounce on everything. So the idea was, what's so interesting about this? So scientists started to think of it as more just noise, something that was kind of a byproduct of having an autobiographical memory and having anxieties, than something that was actually interesting. That changed maybe in the 80s or 90s. There's a professor at UC Santa Cruz named William Dumhoff. And what he did was he collected 50,000 dreams, dream logs, and he looked at them just as if they were short stories. Who was the plot? Who were the characters? What happened? And he kind of introduced data to dreams. It was no longer this metaphysical, surreal world. It was what's actually going on. And he found that most dreams are, by and large, negative. It's, you know, people are attacked. People dislike you. It's kind of like the worst days of middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically an idea that, you know, if we are going through all these terrible things and there's nothing else to kind of compete with our minds for our attention, we're going to go to the worst case scenario.
Well, you know, since you mentioned Freud, I should say that a psychiatrist once told me, well, let me rephrase that. My psychiatrist once told me that a dream I had, which seemed to fix a problem, you know, you do have these dreams where everything works out well. He referred to that as a repairing dream. I don't know if that's mm-hmm. a term that's used in psychiatry, whether he just, you know, cooked that up himself. But those dreams happen too. It's not mm-hmm. just the traumatic sort of middle school kind of things, but there are the moments of reconciliation with somebody who you're having a problem with, or maybe the opportunity to tell somebody off who you've been frustrated in your ability to do that. And then you wake up and it's like, oh, man, that didn't happen.
There's definitely moments of clarity in dreams, too.
Right. Well, do we know what's going on in the brain, Dr. Gerber? Do we know what's going on in the brain? Is anything different happening to the brain when a good dream happens?
You know, I don't think we've ever been able to study it in that exact way. But what I would say is that you're both referring to an idea that the brain is constantly trying to make sense of things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a built-in function of our mental apparatus, essentially, to try to piece things together. And this really is a theme that I think runs throughout the different guys who've theorized or women who've theorized about dreams, is that the brain takes a bunch of this information, if we can call it that, sensory information, input from the outside world, body states, and says, how do I piece all these things together? And in doing so, you could imagine that's kind of, and I put this in quotes, a solution to a problem. It's how do I mix these things together? Now, it doesn't say it's a good solution. It could be a solution that ends up not working out for you. But, you know, as David points out in his terrific book, there are a whole bunch of people who've described throughout history of getting inspiration from their dreams. You know, the most famous one I remember learning is about August Kekulé, who says that he finally got the idea for how the benzene ring worked by dreaming about a snake biting its own tail. And you have lots of those stories. So I think it speaks to this notion that we're trying to solve problems. Again, I put that in quotes because if we anthropomorphize the brain and say it's doing that because it wants to, we're always on thin ice with that. But in some very basic sense, that is what our brains do.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and this week's Please Explain segment is all about dreams, nightmares, what makes them happen. I'm talking to neuroscientist Dr. Andrew Gerber and journalist and author of Dreamland, David K. Randall. And if you have questions about dreams, what the brain is doing during your dreams, or if you've been having weird dreams and want to know more about why, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. We actually do have a couple of questions from people, which I'd like to pass on to you. George in Bay Ridge asks, how does our diet affect our dreams and nightmares? Is that something you've
I'm not aware it's something that people have studied directly, but it's certainly an interesting question that I think we've all heard, for example, the tale that if you eat late, if you're digesting or have indigestion while you're asleep, that impacts your dreams. And I think that it seems very clear that your body's input to your dreams, whether that be because your stomach hurts or because your leg hurts or because you hear a beeping off in the distance, all of those find their ways frequently into our dreams. So it certainly makes sense to me that if your diet is affecting how you feel in terms of your body, it's going to affect your dreams.
Mm-hmm. And another question that's come up from Brooke in the Bronx. Brooke asked, does the vividness of dreams and nightmares diminish with age? That sounds like spoken perhaps from personal experience from Brooke in the Bronx.
The studies I've seen have shown that not necessarily. What you dream about changes with age. And when you age, you're not necessarily going to be in as deep a sleep. So you might not spend as much time in REM sleep, which is when you have the most vivid dreams and when most, if not all, dreams occur. You know, as you age, not surprisingly, teenage boys dream about sex more than anything else. When you get to middle age, you tend to dream about your coworkers. You tend to dream about what's happening in your day. And then as you get older, you either dream about, you know, the people who are still in your life or the people you've lost. When I went to, you know, dream groups to talk with them about what people were dreaming about, so many of them, most of their dreams were saying, you know, I had this opportunity to speak with my father again, who's been, you know, passed away 8 years ago or 10 years ago. And that dream was very vivid to them because it was so meaningful.
Mm-hmm. We said dream groups?
Yeah.
What are dream groups?
Essentially like a book group, but
people talk about their dreams.
Yeah, you're making up all the plot in your head.
Wow. So I've never heard of this before. How common are dream groups?
There were common enough that I was able to go to several in the city. I think it's something that, you know, as people have easier ways to connect with people, with others, you know, whether it's Facebook or meetup group or anything else, it's a way to connect and talk about things that are meaningful to them and, you know, run everything that's going on in your life with somebody else. People I spoke with, there were probably 8 to 10 at every group, and their ages range from, you know, somebody like me who's 30 to 33 to somebody who's 70 or 80.
Mm-hmm. We have a question actually from Dallas. Somebody is listening in Dallas. Daria asked on our show page, if one remembers dreams in vivid detail just before awakening, what does that reveal, if anything, about the quality or stage of sleep right before waking up?
That's a terrific question, and one that really goes right to the heart of some of the more recent dream research, particularly that done by Alan Hobson and his colleagues at Harvard, who've thought and studied very carefully these chemical differences in dreams. So the first idea that's important is to get the sort of general notion of sleep architecture. It's made its way into our culture in lots of ways, but it goes something like this, that as we start to fall asleep, particularly as adults, it's a little different in kids, we drift into deeper and deeper sleep, but a kind of sleep called slow wave sleep. And that's a sleep where most of our brain is not active, and the parts of the brain that form these kinds of narratives is in somewhat hibernation. If we do that in an appropriate order, we can then enter into a kind of sleep called REM sleep, or rapid eye movement sleep. Mm-hmm. What distinguishes REM sleep, besides the fact that our eyes start to move, is the fact that parts of the brain wake up while the rest of the brain is still asleep. In particular, the parts of the brain that dictate the formations of long-term memories or the conversion of short-term into long-term, and the parts of the brain that make you move, those are still asleep and paralyzed. But the parts that tell stories wakes up. And that's the time of sleep when, if you wake somebody up from that period, their dreams are the most vivid. Mm-hmm. Now, originally it was thought that was the only time you dreamt. It turns out that's not so clear, that actually you can wake people up from non-REM sleep or slow-wave sleep and still get dream reports. But they're much less vivid. They're much more of that kind of general feeling dream I was talking about before. So to answer her question, clearly, if you wake up and you're in the middle of a vivid dream, that's because you were in REM sleep.
I should mention at this point that WNYC is launching a new crowdsourcing project this month called Clock Your Sleep. Go to wnyc.org/sleep to learn how to track your own sleep online or with our new app. Is there anything WNYC can't do? And find out how it compares to everyone else's sleep. Okay. I'm talking to Dr. Andrew Gerber, a neuroscientist at Columbia University and journalist David K. Randall, about how our brains can invent such memorable and realistic dreams and nightmares for this week's Please Explain. And if you have a question, give us a call at 212-433-9692. Leave a comment on our show page. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is @LeonardLopate. And we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. And this week's Please Explain is all about dreams, nightmares, what makes them happen, what do they mean even. If you have any questions, you can call us at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page or on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @LeonardLopate. Is there an evolutionary purpose for dreams? Is there a reason why we dream?
So people have been puzzling about this question for a long time, and I'm sure David can tell us about some of the answers that have come up along. But I can tell you about where science is with that question now and what some of the leading theories are. The consensus really comes down to an idea that, a little bit like I was talking about before, the brain during sleep, particularly during REM sleep, is inundated by all these impulses, these the senses, these body experiences. And the brain puts those together. So then the question naturally would become, well, why do that? Why even have the brain on, essentially, during the night to put these things together? And the idea that's been around for a while but's recently gathered a lot of support from experiments is that a necessary function of sleep, and of particularly of REM sleep, is to consolidate those memories, that information that was gathered particularly in the previous day, but not exclusively so, into coherent long-term memories that then get stored for later use, while at the same time letting the other information that doesn't fit into that coherent package go. Our brains, like any memory system, are limited. And not only are they limited by their total capacity, but our body's energy sources are limited. And our brains take a disproportionate amount of energy from the rest of our body. So if we allowed ourselves to just keep storing, to keep building neural connections with no limiting factor on that, we would quickly run out of energy and overheat. But instead, every night when we sleep, our brains are consolidating what we should remember and letting go what we don't. There are nuances of that description that I think are certainly under debate. But as a general theory, I think that has a lot of support.
Okay, we're going to take Sarah from Manhattan who has a question. Sarah, are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I have a question about infants and dreaming. I read online briefly that infants don't dream, but I have a two-month-old, and he makes faces and noises, and he smiles, and he's like a puppy when he dreams or when he's sleeping. So I wondered if he is dreaming or not.
Okay.
It's a neat question, and one that I actually think we know something about. I was actually talking earlier today with a friend and colleague named Bill Pfeiffer at Columbia, who does a lot of research onto the neural activity of not just newborns, but fetuses even. And one thing we know really without much doubt is that there's a lot of REM sleep in fetuses and in newborns. In fact, more REM sleep proportionately than in children or certainly adults. During those stages of REM sleep, we see those fetuses and young children be very active. So exactly the things you're describing. And of course, it would then be reasonable for us to conclude that something like dreaming is going on. Now, it's a little hard to say what we mean by something like, because after all, your newborn can't tell us what their experience. And it's reasonable to think that, of course, their dream doesn't have the same narrative structure that our dreams do. They don't have language associated with those dreams. But they are clearly having some experience of trying to pull these things together. And we could even speculate a little further that that's essential for the growth and development of the newborn brain.
Mm-hmm. David, you mentioned we were talking about cats before and what cats do when they're asleep. What do we know about mammals and other animals and their dreams?
That the essentially the same structure goes through the animal kingdom, that there is something that looks like REM sleep in cats and dogs. How much sleep they get and how important that sleep is still up for debate. A giraffe, for instance, will only sleep for an hour and a half a night, and most hoofed animals won't sleep all that much. So maybe their brains don't need it in the same way that a human brain needs it. The brain really is our evolutionary advantage. We can figure out not only how to develop tools and everything else, but we can think about how we're thinking. And part of what the brain, part of what sleeping does and what dreams do is a way to, consolidate that information to give us a run through of the next day, go through our anxieties, perhaps having a dress rehearsal, and then to put things in perspective as well. There have been theories that, if you are having the same nightmare again and again, perhaps that's because your brain hasn't kind of reached an emotional stage of that where you can accept it. And you're replaying this almost a horror movie again and again until you kind of figure it out. And then, once you get past that, that shows that, the brain can move on. It's been able to put this into long-term memory successfully.
Well, speaking of bad dreams. We have a question about night terrors from Christian in Northdale. Christian, are you with us?
Hi, yes. Thanks. So my question about night terrors is, where did these stem from? Are these just heightened nightmares, or are they something entirely different where our brain's not really in complete control, but our body can almost wake up, but we're still almost paralyzed?
Right. So a very important topic, and one that maybe I should start by just making sure everybody knows what we mean by night terrors. So night terrors are thought of as a phenomenon that happens more commonly in children, but not in all children, in which, as you say, there's a partial wakening. Sometimes these kids will get out of bed. Sometimes they'll start to walk around. They're not fully awake, yet they're clearly experiencing some very a vivid emotion.
And their eyes will be open, so they'll appear awake.
That's right. And what we know about one thing is it's hard to wake kids from night terrors. And if you do succeed at it, there's an old wives' tale that says you shouldn't even try, that it's dangerous. No such thing, but it's hard to do. And if you do succeed in waking them, they have very little memory. Often no memory at all of what happened. And that comes back to something we were talking about before, that night terrors happen during slow-wave, non-REM sleep. That is that synthetic consolidating activity that David and I have been talking about that happens in REM sleep and narrative dreams is not going on during that period. Now, what happens in terms of the balance of neurochemicals that causes one child to wake up and another not to, we don't fully know. We probably know what some of the suspects are, though. This is, again, something that the folks at Harvard have studied, Alan Hobson has studied very carefully. There are some well-known neurochemicals, in particular acetylcholine, which functions to really dampen some of the motor processes during REM sleep. And there are other amines, in particular norepinephrine or noradrenaline and serotonin, that come on that do the opposite during sleep. And we think there's probably some imbalance of those that goes on in the so-called parasomnias or in things like night terrors. Partly we know that because when we give various medications, and many if not all of our psychiatric medications affect the relative concentrations and receptors for these different neurochemicals, you have a fairly direct effect on dreams. And it's certainly something worth studying further.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC, WNYC.org. This week's Please Explain segment is all about dreams and nightmares. I'm talking to two dream experts, Dr. Andrew Gerber, a neuroscientist, and journalist David K. Randall, who is the author of Dreamland. And I'll mention again that WNYC is launching a new crowdsourcing project this month called Clock Your Sleep. If you go to WNYC.org/sleep, you can learn how to track your own sleep online or with our new app and find out how it compares to everyone else's. And if you have questions for our two experts, we still have a few minutes left, you can call us at 212-433-9692. Let's go to Jessica in Edison, New Jersey.
Sure.
Jessica.
Hi.
Did I wake you? Sounded like something was going on there.
No, sorry. I'm calling from New Jersey. I have a question about a heated mattress pad because it was such a cold winter. We bought a heated mattress pad. Sometimes it gets left on. And ever since I had the heated mattress pad, I'm having the most vivid dreams. And I'm wondering what is the connection between body temperature and dreams?
Thank you. We are also fielding all of your calls about heated mattress pads today. Anything, any issues you're having regarding those, these two also know a lot about that topic. What about the temperature and the effect on dreams? Is there anything to that?
I think one thing is, you know, temperature itself is part of why we sleep. It's a way to regulate our bodies. Something that might make you have these, you know, vivid memories is that maybe it has an effect on you're sleeping more, you're having more REM sleep. So then when you're waking up, you're remembering these vivid memories because they just happened. One thing that's interesting about dreams as well is that as you go through the night, the first dreams you have typically tend to be just replays of your day. You think of, you know, what everything that happened. And it's as you get farther in the night, you know, five in the morning right before you wake up, those are when dreams seem the most strange because your brain is constantly trying to make as many connections as possible between what's happening. So if you're waking up from that, they can seem very vivid. You know, you're in this situation that seems so real, and then it's completely gone. And that's simply a result of REM sleep and how your body goes through the night.
Sometimes I feel if I wake up, say, half an hour before I'm supposed to, I might as well just get up and begin my day, because that last half hour of dreams, if I have them, will be just really weird and will get me off to a very bad start. But maybe that's just me. I don't know.
It's not just you. There have been studies with people playing Tetris who, you know, when they play right before they go to sleep, right after they go to sleep, they remember, you know, the shapes falling exactly. Then when if you wake them up, you know, 8 hours later, they're trying to make connections. They're saying, you know, I saw buildings falling and they were colored. And this way, it's obviously Tetris, but it's trying to make this connection between something it already knows.
Josh in Colorado asks, how does marijuana affect our dreams and nightmares? That would be a call from Colorado. Josh, I wonder why you're asking that. He also wants to know how drugs like alcohol and anti-anxiety medications affect dreams. I've heard I would imagine the effects are pretty big, right?
You know, you're right. As I was mentioning before, most of the psychoactive medications that I've been mentioning, including the ones that we prescribe, but also the ones that are not prescribed, are acting on these chemical neurotransmitter systems that we know about. And so we know that they have a direct effect on dreams and on sleep in general. Beyond that, I think we certainly have clinical data to suggest that a range of different substances interfere with the quality of sleep. It's not a surprise to most people that drinking a lot of alcohol interferes with the restfulness and the quality of sleep. And to some extent, marijuana does as well, although I don't know that that's been studied so well. It becomes an issue particularly for people who have a great deal of difficulty falling asleep and end up using either marijuana or alcohol as a sleep aid.
Mm-hmm. And well, alcohol is a bad sleep aid,
exactly.
Right? Because it's very disruptive.
That's right. People sometimes will think, well, it got me to sleep.
Right.
That's good. And it isn't, because the quality of sleep you then get is quite poor. And marijuana, I believe, is quite similar. The anti-anxiety medicines are it's a little bit less clear. Some of them, or many of them, actually work on similar circuits, or at least on the GABA receptor that is implicated in alcohol as well, but without some obvious differences. So it's possible that they aren't as helpful for some kinds of sleep as we wish they were. On the other hand, I can tell you from certainly working with a lot of patients that the relief that people can get when they know that there's a way they can get to sleep and that can calm them down enough to get to sleep can make a tremendous difference. So it's a complicated question. I don't think there's any easy answer to who should be or shouldn't be taking these things, but one that people should think about.
Mm-hmm. Any encounters with drugs, marijuana in your studies, in your scholarly studies?
My non-scholarly subject study of myself has shown that alcohol obviously doesn't help you sleep. But
right.
One thing that I think is really interesting in many people who have anxiety, image rehearsal therapy is a form of therapy that works, and it's basically trying to be the director of your dream and not just sitting through a nightmare.
Well, okay, we're going to have to, on that interesting note, we're going to have to dip out of here. But thanks a lot, guys. I've been speaking with Dr. Andrew Gerber of Columbia University and David K. Randall, the author of Dreamland, Adventures in the Strange Science of Sleep, on today's Please Explain, all about dreams and nightmares. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks for having us.